This episode of the Driven Engineers podcast is sponsored by umbrella.co.uk.
On this episode of the Driven Engineers podcast, we are thrilled to welcome Franco Chiocchetti, CEO and founder of Race On. Franco has over 25 years of engineering and management experience and has been at the forefront of motorsport and automotive innovation. From leading Formula E projects for Mercedes-Benz EQ to delivering championship-winning campaigns in DTM and Formula E, his journey is filled with remarkable achievements. His company Race On specializes in cutting-edge engineering solutions, high-performance vehicle dynamics, and sustainable racing technologies. Today, we're going to dive into his career, Race On's global expansion, and the future of motorsport engineering. So let's get started. Hello, Franco. How are you?
Hi there. Thanks, Matt. I'm well and yourself?
Yeah, very good. Thank you very much. I gave you a brief introduction, but I think it's always nice for our guests to introduce themselves. So maybe you could just give us a little introduction, who you are and what you've been doing.
Yeah, so started my career in South Africa. I studied mechanical engineering, University of Cape Town, moved into industry. I did 2 years of industry. It was very interesting as well. But got an opportunity into motorsport, which I jumped at, and spent 2 years in South Africa in South African touring cars, which was similar to PTCC at the time. Jumped across to Europe 2001, up Sportsline, stayed there for a 17-year stint. Spent most of that in the DTM and Formula E, and then moved across to HWA to prepare the project for Mercedes. As the entry there, I spent a couple of seasons there, and then in the middle of that Mercedes stint, we started Race On.
We're going to come on to Race On in a little while and just go through a little bit more about what they're doing and what they're venturing into. So for our listeners, what first inspired you to get into motorsport and motorsport engineering?
Yeah, so when I was studying, times were a bit different. So in South Africa, we didn't have any motorsport engineering courses. So I did the classical mechanical engineering. Why I got into motorsport? Well, I come from a motorsport family. My cousins, my father was involved in motorsport. My cousins are multiple South African champions across many generations. We were always around motorsport. And yeah, when I got the opportunity, I just jumped at it.
That's great. Can you share how your early roles at BMW and Opel Motorsport in South Africa kind of influenced your career? They must have been quite key with laying the foundations of what you went on to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they were both factory teams, which was good from that aspect. But if I think back now, pretty amateurish. It was early days motorsports. It was 99 and 2000. I would say really fundamental to the foundation of my career, just because getting the understanding of motorsport, what the business is, what tasks need to be done, what sort of dedications required, the time commitment, all that was already there at that time. The hours of working, everything that you're not used to in normal industry, we were exposed to already in those early days. And those early days for me was actually primarily as a designer. A design engineer, but in teams in that era, let's say, you were multitasking. So I was in the office, I was a design engineer. At the racetrack, I was a race engineer. I never did the classical route of performance race or systems performance race engineer. That wasn't the case for me. I was, let's say, lucky. I went direct into race engineering. Has its pros and cons, as everything in life. So yeah,
that's great. You must have faced quite a few challenges moving from South Africa to Europe, right? Different cultures, different languages. Can you talk to us about some of those challenges?
Well, I mean, you mentioned most of the challenges. The biggest challenge was the geographical one, moving halfway across the globe. I was 26 at the time, moving halfway across the globe with two suitcases and nothing else to a country which, from a climate perspective, was just on another planet compared to what I was used to.
Sure.
And then from the language perspective, yeah, I mean, I knew no German when I moved to Germany. I was lucky in the fact that at UPT, it was really multicultural. I think we were, I stand to be corrected, but 11 or 13 nations in the team at the time when I was there. So the main language was English. So that was really quite okay. It was more the private life, which was difficult from a language perspective. But at that time, those days in that day and age, we were working so much.
Really?
It wasn't much private life, to be honest.
Just working all the hours that were there, and lots of overtime and putting the graft in. Yeah, that's
exactly.
And as the technical director for ABT Sportsline during Formula E's early days, what were the most significant hurdles for you in designing and managing electric race cars?
Yeah, I mean, it was a huge learning curve for me. I mean, I came off 15 seasons of DTM. Suddenly going into an all-electric championship, I have no solid foundation of electrical engineering or anything like that. So it was really, in my case, a scenario of learning multiple new things every day, which was super challenging and super exciting. I mean, engineers want to be challenged and want to learn new things all the time. So from that perspective, it was really interesting for me. Completely different to what I was doing from a management style. I mean, it's more a question of relying on your experts and absorbing the information which your experts are giving you before making the final decisions. And we worked really well together as a team. I mean, I was leading it, yes, from a technical perspective, but we worked really it was a group effort.
So without giving too much away, what innovations or strategies were crucial to securing the Formula E titles with Mercedes-Benz EQ and ABT Sportsline? Don't need to give away your secrets, but what was the most important thing? You mentioned the team now. I imagine a team effort is probably going to be quite high up the priority list there, but whatever things were important?
It's about having that unified approach, you know. A team is not always a team. If you take two aspects of the word, you know, for me, both organizations, we were a team in that everyone was pulling the rope in one direction. We never or very seldom had people challenging the final decisions that were made, and everyone was working to the same in the same direction. And that's important, you know. People need to have the buy-in. You have to have the buy-in that what you're doing is the right thing. And in both organizations, this was there. You know, and then it's also the culture. The culture is also super important. You can have the team with the best technical people, but if you can't work as a team, if you don't have the right team culture, it's going to be very difficult to have success. Yeah. So things like no blame culture, you know, a phrase which came, I think, from Mercedes times was see it, say it, fix it. You know, if you see something, tell someone. Make sure it gets sorted, you know, don't just sweep it under the carpet. And that's extremely important, you know, but that only works with the no blame culture, you know, because if you see something and say, if I say this, Mr. X is going to get into trouble, I'm rather not going to say it, you know. So those things all come together, and it's a lot about the attitude. For sure, you need to have the technical brains, which I believe we had in both organizations, because the success was there. Times were quite different, though. I need to also say that, you know, when we were operating in season 3, when we won the championship with Abt, it was different times and different levels than when we won it with Mercedes.
Sure. That's really, really good advice. And I think a philosophy that people can take, the people that are listening, that no blame culture you can use in any walk of life, right? You can use that in any team, in any industry. So I think that's really, really good. So how did your role evolve then when moving from race engineer in DTM to leading an entire Formula E team?
A lot of learning by doing. I mean, at the end, it's a lot about taking your own personal experiences and what was good, what was bad from your previous managers and how you saw them from your side. And taking this and trying to apply this now from the other side, you know. Wanting the people to, or wanting your group to accept you, and wanting them to see you as the leader, you know. At the end of the day, like I said, leadership is quite easy when everyone's pulling in the same direction. So it's more a question of leading in the way that you're supplying everyone the right tools to do their job, that you're basically making their life easier to do their job. And everyone's enjoying doing their job, what they are doing. So it more or less just works. It might sound strange, but it is like that. It more or less just works. Once you're sure that everyone's enjoying what they're doing, once everyone's pulling in the same direction, the rest more or less falls into place. For sure, for me, it was a big jump, not only going from a race engineer to leading a leading the development, but also to leading a team, and then moving across to A, where I was then responsible for the global project, let's say. Suddenly you're leading not just your own team, but you're leading across a matrix structure, which is an added challenge for sure.
That's great. So when it comes to recruiting your teams, then I have to mention recruitment. We're a recruitment consultancy after all. So I have to get it in somewhere into the podcast, Franco. So, but when you're recruiting your teams then, and you're looking for building those types of cultures and trying to build that no blame attitude, what key qualities do you look for in an engineer?
Yeah, it's a very difficult topic, because to understand character in a 1 hour interview or even in two interviews is very, very difficult. But it's super important. You know, you can have the best technical people, but if they don't have the right character, they can't work in a team. They're not going to be bringing the performance they need to be bringing. And especially for a company like us, as we are consulting, people need to be able to go to teams and to fit in easily. So I think there's not one recipe of you need to have this, this, and this. It's a little bit more a topic about what's your feeling in the meeting, you know. Is it flowing? Is the interview a flowing discussion? Because that's already showing that things are gelling, you know, things that people are able to communicate in the right way and all that type of stuff. So it's a lot about stomach feeling.
So we're going to talk a little bit just about motorsport in general. How has the role of engineering in motorsport evolved in your career? You mentioned earlier on that things were different in the 90s. And I imagine as a designer back then, it was probably, maybe it was more paper and pencil back then. I don't know.
Yeah. So it's exactly what you said. I mean, it's evolved so much, and I've been fortunate to be through so many of those changes. I mean, from, let's say, fax machine to email.
Yeah.
That was already one huge step. The other one was drawing board to CAD. I mean, when I was working in industry, we were doing design on drawing boards. When I moved to motorsport, we started 3D CAD. Not every component like we have now, you know, that you can basically walk through a complete design car and every single component. It was more just some critical components that needed to be done on CAD. I don't know if that was the same case in Europe, you know, as I grew up in South Africa and had that, whereas now when you see the amounts of data which are coming, how quickly the data is presented in a way that you can make decisions, that's quite phenomenal. And we'll just get more and more now, especially with artificial intelligence and the ways of dealing with big data. Everything is evolving so quickly. It's interesting to see. Interesting to see.
Yeah, sure. I can imagine you've seen quite a few changes. Is there a particular technical development that you've witnessed or contributed to that really stands out to you?
I mean, witness technology, I think the biggest one for me and the biggest change was really going from that DTM car to the Formula E and that whole electrical vehicle, electrical race car development. Everything was so new. No one knew what was coming, you know. Mm-hmm. Pushing the boundaries, you saw every year just pushing the boundaries in Formula E from one level to the next. That was pretty innovative and really exciting, to be honest. You know, how far can you go? How much power can you get? Okay, we're always power limited, but how much can you get out of the hardware that you have before everything blows up? And that That was super interesting.
I'm pretty certain I saw you've got a certification in areas like nutrition, Franco. How important is physical and mental well-being in the high-pressure world of motorsport?
Yeah, it's super important. I mean, I did that very long time ago, more out of interest than anything else. But yeah, especially I see now, you know, I've been trackside many, many years, and it gets more and more difficult as you get older. And that whole nutritional, you know, what you eat and making sure that you're doing some exercise, getting some movement, that's super important, not only for overcoming things like jet lag, but just in general. You know, I mean, I'm not a specialist in the field, but everyone's different. And I think it's important to understand a little bit the backgrounds so that you can find out what works for you. You know, some people need sleeping tablets to get through jet lag. Others just get through it normally. Others need to do sport. So everyone's different. And just knowing what's there and how to adapt and finding what works for you is important, I think. We spend so much money on technical performance, but at the end, human performance is one of the biggest factors, because the mistakes are often not coming from the technical performance, they're coming from the human performance.
Yeah, and you've got to be at your peak at that point to make sure that you're making the right decisions in those high-pressure environments.
Absolutely. At the end of the day, it's motorsport. It's still a sport. Even though we are not physically running a marathon, we're still involved in the sport. I mean, I don't need to go into detail about how important nutrition and health and mental health is. It's good to talk about mental health. It's yesterday was Mental Health Day. But yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But that's great. That's really good insights as well. We do forget it's a sport. We look at it, certainly myself as a spectator, I look at it and I think, yeah, you know, everybody needs to be at the peak of their mental well-being and at the peak of their physical well-being as well in order to compete and be the best. So that's that's great insights. Thank you. We're going to talk a little bit about Race On. Could you explain in your own words, what is Race On and what inspired you to create Race On?
Yeah, so I had the concept of Race On in my head for a long time, but never really took the opportunity or never felt I had the opportunity or, let's say, the courage to branch off on my own and to do something like that. When Mercedes wanted to move their Formula E team from Germany across to the UK, the opportunity arose and we had the opportunity to start up Race On and consult to them. Myself and a couple of engineers, we didn't want to move across to the UK, and that was the solution that we had to continue working with Mercedes. The concept of Race On, you know, it's a bunch of people who are just passionate about what we do. We have a lot of fun being trackside. We have a lot of fun competing. From my experiences working many, many years in one championship, going every year to the same racetrack, seeing the same people, at one stage it does get a little bit boring. And Race On gives engineers an opportunity to work in multiple championships without having to change location or change employer, et cetera, et cetera. So, we consult out. We supply engineers to teams, not on a weekend basis. We try to do it on a yearly basis and even on a bi-yearly basis. We focus on top level. Our engineers are able to hit the ground running. They are basically specialists in their field, or the majority for sure. We have some who are more junior, but the majority are really specialists in their field and able to join a team and make a difference.
That's fantastic. And from maybe a client side as well, sometimes the fact that they're getting new faces and fresh faces in different seasons and new ideas could also benefit them as well, I assume.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess we need to talk about IP. Because, you know, when you're consulting, IP is a big topic for us. It's something which we take really seriously. I mean, we need to, otherwise our business model would be short-lived. You know, we are always straight up with our clients. I can give a real-life example. You know, an engineer says to me, I've been doing this championship now a long time. I want to see something different. So we inform the customer. The customer is aware that it will be the last season. We ensure that the person is training up the person who will replace them. And we also give assurance to the customer that the engineer is not going to the competition, of course. So, from that perspective, it's really nice to have the the variety, but also to work together with the customers, you know, that they are aware what the situation is. The thing is, with a freelancer, you cannot have any restrictions on a freelancer. So they can work for you today and work for your competition tomorrow. And you have, it's very, very difficult to have any type of non-competition clauses or something like that. That's where the difference comes in, let's say.
That's great. Could you talk to us about Raceon expanding into the US market as well? What unique opportunities or challenges have you identified in American motorsport compared to Europe?
Yeah, there's a lot of challenges. I mean, opening up Raceon Incorporated was the first challenge. I mean, it's not super easy to get all the administrative stuff done. The next challenge within the industry is more or less about the acceptance. You know, we need to make people aware of what we're doing and how we're doing it. And of course, as you said, they do things quite differently there. So we need to convince them that we can come across to the US and we can enhance what they're doing. I think when you look at the way work is being done in the US compared to Europe, I think Europe is much more data-driven, whereas in the US, they are working a lot more on experience. Technology is still very high. I mean, what they are doing and how they are doing it is still exceptionally good and on a high level. They make a lot more decisions based on experience. You know, we've been here before. This is what worked in the past. Whereas in Europe, I think we are focusing a lot more on the data-driven approach. And I think the two enhance each other. I don't say one's better than the other. I think you need both. Perhaps we need a little bit more Americanization in European motorsport, and we need a little bit more Europeanization, if that's even a word, in USA motorsport. And that's what we would like to do. You know, if we can accomplish to take all the positives from European motorsport and all the positives from US motorsport, we can supply in the end a better product.
Yeah, you're going to help that natural blend between the two markets.
Exactly.
Is there any are there any technological trends coming out of the US market that might benefit the European market in the future, do you know?
Oh, not that I'm aware. I mean, let's say Europe has jumped very quickly onto the sustainability topic, onto electric motorsport or hybrid motorsport that we've seen in some championships. Whereas US, although they've gone to hybrid in some championships like IndyCar, in IMSA for sure with the hypercars, but generally they are technology wise lagging a little bit behind. Well, we say lagging. They might feel that they're ahead.
What do you think the future holds for motorsport, both in terms of technology and competition, and where do you see things heading in the next decade?
Yeah, that's a very tricky question, Matt. Let's put it this way. It's called motorsport. There'll always be a motor. What type of motor that will be is difficult to say at the moment. I think the whole automotive industry, I'm not going to go into the topic because I think there's been enough said about it, but no one really knows what the direction is at the moment. And I think until we find that direction, we mustn't forget motorsport is a marketing tool. As long as we don't know what to market, it's going to be very difficult to know which direction things are going. I mean, at the moment, it's like a playground. Everything's possible, from hydrogen combustion to e-fuels to electric to hybrid. I mean, there's everything out there. This is not going to be decided by motorsport. This is by the automotive industry and all politicians, whoever's making that decision. There will always be racing. I mean, people will always compete. People have been competing since as long as history can remember. So there will always be competition. So I'm not afraid that motorsport will fall away or die away, let's say. I believe there will always be some form of motorsport. We just need to be flexible enough, especially as a company like Raceon, to adapt to the technologies which are coming, be able to hit the ground running.
Right, that's great. And if somebody listening to this podcast was interested in securing Raceon services or needed to contact you, Franco, what would be the best way of reaching out to you?
Oh, there's many ways. I mean, LinkedIn profile is probably the easiest. There's our website, which engineers can apply for positions, or companies can reach out. They can even make a direct appointment with me on the website. So There's multiple ways. At the end of the day, it's about having people knowing that we're there and what we can do. You know, I'm well aware that not everyone's going to want to work with Raison. And we wouldn't be able to support everyone. But it's just important that people know that we're there, they know what we're doing, and they know if they do need us, they know where to find us.
That's great. I'm going to finish up with one last question for you, Franco. Mm-hmm. And it's one I like to ask a lot of our guests when they come onto the podcast. But we have a younger audience. We've got a lot of people that will listen in to try and understand how they can make their break into motorsport or into Formula One or any of the formulas, really. For young engineers then aspiring to follow in your footsteps, what advice would you give to them to succeed?
Yeah, the road's not easy. So, I mean, if I just take my own experiences, my move from South Africa to Europe, I sent out over 50 CVs.
Wow.
I got 2 responses and I got 1 job offer. So even back then, it wasn't easy. And I was coming with 2 years experience already. I mean, a lot of people are coming direct from university and looking for positions, even though, I mean, for sure, Formula Student helps. It's a big help for them to understand the business, but it's not what I call industry experience. So it's difficult. Don't give up. You need to have a dream. You need to follow your dream. If people follow me on LinkedIn, they will have seen I've done a small posting about dreams. You need to keep following your dream and never give up. But you need to also make sure you have the right foundations. Mm-hmm. So for sure, Formula Student is a fantastic foundation. You know, especially on a company like Raison, we need trackside experience. So it's difficult for us to take people direct from Formula Student who've never seen what's happening on a racetrack. So my advice is really get out there. You know, if you look, there's every weekend there's a race somewhere.
Yeah.
If you look just in Europe, every weekend there's a race somewhere. There's a lot of GT stuff going on. Just get out there. Offer your services. Even if you're getting $20 a day, just do it for the experience. It's an investment in your future. But that's super important. We are always advertising for high experience levels because, as I said, we're trying to stay on top level and we're looking for people who can really hit the ground running.
Sure. Yeah. That's really good advice, Franco. Appreciate that. And I think anybody listening will take that on board. And I think persistence is key, and just put your hand up for anything. And there's a lot of voluntary work out there as well that people can go and help around tracks and things like that. So, but that's really good advice. Franco, we're going to wrap it up there. I really, really want to thank you for taking the time today. I know how busy your schedule is, traveling between the US and Europe. I want to just thank you again. And it'd be really good if you could keep in touch with us.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Matt. It's been a really interesting conversation and it's been a pleasure. So thank you and we'll stay in touch.